Ms. Key, welcome. This is Molly's second session. Molly's just got back from hiking to Heart Lake with her three kids, so we'll have to ask her about that afterwards, but she said it was beautiful. Molly is from North Dakota State University in public health and in nursing, and today she's going to share menstrual hygiene management in rural Kenya and kind of building global health partnerships. So thank you, Molly.
Thanks. So last time, I think some of you were here and you heard about sort of the background for the need for menstrual hygiene management in rural Kenya. And my focus today is going to be to talk more about and tell the story of the process of how we started this project of working to address the need for menstrual hygiene management in rural Kenya. So I'll talk more today about the specifics of what we've been doing and how we got there. So, in case you don't know where Kenya is, it's in East Africa. And where we work specifically is in an area called Tharaka-Nithi County, which is here in kind of central Kenya. It's about a 4-hour drive from Nairobi, and it's just located at the base of Mount Kenya. So I really appreciate looking at a map of the continent of Africa, because one of the things that happens a lot of times is people say, oh, you're going to Africa. And I say, oh, no, actually, I'm just going to Kenya. Like, this is the entire continent is called Africa. And I have not been to all of those countries, nor do I ever go to all of them at once. The other thing that's sort of fun to look at is that throughout the work, you know, there is a lot happening on the continent of Africa, including during the time we've been working there, the outbreak of Ebola. So it's fun to look at this because people were always like, why are you going to Kenya? Ebola, what about Ebola? Well, if you look, where Ebola was happening was in Western Africa, right along the coast. And Kenya is actually further, or West Africa where Ebola was actually closer to England than it was to Kenya. So if you put it into perspective, it's kind of an interesting thing to look at. But anyway, there's Kenya, and here's where we work within the country. So the way I got started doing my work in Kenya is because of the woman in this picture, whose name is Millicent Garama. So I met her in 1996 when I was 19 years old and had just finished my sophomore year of college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, except for I was going to school in Bellingham. I had lived in Fargo my whole life, and I knew that I liked being outside, skiing, hiking, and wasn't like just trying to figure out what I would do that allowed me to do those things. So I went to Kenya thinking I was going to get a degree in geology, because that seems like what you would do if you liked being outside. And I met Millicent at a hospital with my mom was with on the trip. It was a church trip. And Millicent said, oh, what do you want to do? And my mom said, oh, she thinks she wants to be a nurse. And I was like, I don't think I do. But she said that. So Millicent said, oh, go in that room. Someone's about to have a baby. And I mean, you can imagine being 19 years old shoved into a delivery room in a sub-Saharan African country where there's not much happening except for a woman just literally having a baby. And I watched the delivery happen, and my life was forever changed, and I was like, oh, actually, I think I might want to be a nurse. That was really awesome. I was really just completely struck by what happens in the rest of the world and how different it is, yet how much it is the same in all parts of the world. So thinking women have babies the exact same, I mean, the process of having a baby is basically the same everywhere. And so she really inspired my interest in global health. So I met her again in 2010 when I went back to do, 2011, I went back to do a research project. And so it's been really fun to connect with her. And she has a place called the Family Resource Center. So I worked together with her for a couple years just talking about public health. She has a background in public health, and we kind of started on some projects together. So in the fall of 2012, together with Millicent, we did a research project that I talked briefly about in the last session, where we did some focus group interviews with schools in rural Kenya in the county, in Tharaka-Nithi County. So the first school that we visited was called Kare, and this is some of the girls from the school. And they were really telling us about the barriers and facilitators of adolescent health. And during that time, they, as I mentioned, talked about challenges for girls. So they really talked about the challenge of attending school after the onset of puberty, largely because of menstruation. Again, the poor school sanitation and lack of private toilets. not having access to sanitary pads, and then a really big lack of information about sexual and reproductive health and the biology of menstruation. So here's a quick overview. This is what I was trying to describe in my last presentation. If you haven't seen a latrine in a country like rural Kenya, this is what it looks like. So again, the challenges include missing many days of school because of menstruation and limited access to menstrual products, and then the use of the alternative methods that can cause some health issues to girls who are using things like dirt or plastic bags, old clothes, for trying to manage their menstruation. And then because of that link to broader gender inequalities, this was really an issue that became important to me. So I came back after this research and started thinking about washable sanitary pads. So this is an example of what one can look like. And I thought, this seems like an environmental issue, and there must be lots of people around the world who use pads that you wash because they care about the environment. So I started looking on the internet and searched for different patterns and found this pattern and thought, okay, I'm going to take more students back to Kenya in 2013. I'm going to see if they would be interested in sewing some of these pads. So I asked the students, these are four of the five who went that year, if they wanted to start making some pads. And I thought maybe they'd be like, eh, sure, we'll make 10. But they became super excited. This is in the university. This is in one of the classrooms. And they were prepping all of these pads in preparation for a fraternity to come and help them sew pads. People all over campus, they have service organizations, and they have to get a certain number of service hours. So it suddenly turned out that all of these different student organizations were talking about menstruation and sewing pads. And then people started kind of making them. These people were from rural areas of North Dakota. Their grandmas were sewing them. Their church groups were sewing them. So people just started kind of making them. And I thought, you know, we'd maybe show up with 50 pads. And the first year, we brought close to 1,000 pads with us. And so this is us arriving in the airport in Nairobi. And that year, we did our first pad distribution in the Tharaka Nithi County. The reason why we choose to work in this county is because we already had connections there. My mom has worked in Kenya for a long time. And this is the area that she's worked in. So this area, even though where we stay is actually really close to the base of Mount Kenya and it receives a lot of rainfall every year and it has plenty of food, this area is maybe 10 or 15 kilometers away, but it takes about 2.5 hours by car to drive there because the roads are non-existent. And it is very different climate. They have a lot of drought and it is very, very few resources. In many of the areas, they do not even really use any cash transfers. They have really high rates of primary school dropout for girls and boys. And so this year we, 3,000 pads the first year. I think I said 1,000, but we had a lot of pads this year. And this is our picture of our first distribution. I think at the last session someone asked about what it was like, and I was telling about the principal who chased us down the road telling us thank you and was so excited. This was at that school. So this is our very first distribution. And again, we had no idea what it was going to be like. I didn't know if people were going to be happy we bought pads or what we would actually talk about if the girls would come. And so this is us sitting under the tree doing the first distribution. Our experience this time and continues to be that the girls receive this information much like any middle school girls would receive this sort of information. They're shy and laugh and are embarrassed, but this is them writing on pieces of paper where they could ask questions that they had. Again, you can see them being shy. We gave them a pad package that contained one washable sanitary pad shield and or two shields and then 8 liners that go inside of the pad, as well as 2 pairs of underwear and an instruction sheet. It's interesting because one of the lessons that we've learned is that they are, again, just like all middle school and high school age girls, and they actually care a lot about what their panties look like and a lot about what the pads look like. So when we first had people making these pads, I was like, oh yeah, you could just upcycle flannel sheets and flannel shirts, make whatever you have with what's already stuff that you've already used. But it turned out, and then the underwear, I was like, oh, any underwear is fine. girls need underwear, but it turned out that they were very specific about the style of panties. They did not want any white ones, gray ones, beige ones. So it was really, it was fun. You know, I thought just because people would think, oh, people who are poor and don't have anything, they would just take anything, isn't true. People still have a preference and have their own opinions and desires and likes. So after this first year, this was a successful distribution. We were here at this school, McKenge, and then we also went to another place, Kare. So we started a project. I decided we might as well just introduce this as part of a service learning project for the students so that every year we go, we would continue making the pads. And I had this flyer made, and we started kind of this idea of giving a girl her wings so that every day can be a school day. And in that next year of trying to think about how we might make more pads so that we could reach more schools, I was just hanging out with my friends who kept saying, we want to make pads, let's all get together and make pads. And I thought, okay, well, we all like drinking beer, so can we go to the brewery and we'll just all sit in the brewery? And Fargo is just these open picnic tables, and it's, they don't like serve food or anything, so they just serve beer in their picnic tables. So I asked them if we could come and bring some sewing machines and sew pads and drink beer, thinking that maybe like 10 or 15 of my friends would come. And we ended up having this event that we decided to call Pints and Pads. And we it got in the newspaper and was covered in several local media sources. And I think there were over 150 people that came that were people I had no idea who they were. People, this man sewing was the very first person who showed up at the brewery. He stayed until it was completely done. There were just people sewing and making pads, and it was wildly successful and shocking to me. So next year took even more pads. So this is the next year of students. You can see that we do our education in lots of settings. So we can, this next year we were still working with just Millicent, but we've been trying to figure out how could we partner with more people in the schools, because as we continued growing and as more people started making pads, and we could really tell that it was meeting a need and being well received in Kenya, we wanted to figure out how can we continue doing this where we're not like a organization that just comes by and drops pads and leaves, because we weren't really interested in doing that. So this year we expanded and started working more closely and involving the teachers. This year, what this school up at the top is something that really stuck out to me, because those girls were so delighted, and they, you can see they're walking home with all their pads, and I just said to the teacher, oh, they're so excited. I didn't expect them to be so excited to get pads. And the teacher said, well, many of these girls have never had something that was theirs before. Like, they have never owned something before. This is the first time they've ever had something that actually belongs to them. So that's probably one of my favorite parts of participating in this, is watching girls walk away so thrilled that they've been given something. And then you can see at the bottom, they are excited about panties, which is sort of fun. So this is in 2014, and this year my family and I stayed in Kenya. I went with the students in April, and my family joined me, and we stayed until the end of July, so we were there several months. And during that time, my mom brought a group of Presbyterians from her presbytery for a work trip in Kenya. And as a part of that, we did a medical camp. And it was in a remote area where they set up with the hospital a camp where you could serve patients, usually about 1,500 patients in a day, all kinds of medical services. And we had extra pads, so I said to the person organizing, could we give out some pads when we're there? And they said, yeah, I don't think anyone's really going to take the pads, so you can just set up kind of behind in this little house, like outside area behind a house, and if people want pads, they can come get them. So I said, okay, and went over there, and we're setting up, and probably within 10 minutes of beginning to give out some pads, there was a mob of people, like lots of people, over 100 people just suddenly swarming trying to get pads. So we ended up having to move to this little closet-like thing where we were passing out pads. And again, I was already worried, like, is this a good thing to do? Do people actually need these? But there ended up being such a long line that there was a pastor standing there with a switch and, it, like, you know, threatening people. And I have never seen anything like it, telling them to get away. And then we were having women who were, like, in their 80s coming to ask for pads. And so we said, okay, You can only come and get a pad if you have a school uniform on, or else if you have a baby and are obviously of reproducing age and can have menstruation. So you can see down at the bottom that women were coming with babies tied to them, and they kept coming, and after a while I was like, wait a second, that's the same baby. So they were just going and passing a baby around, coming to get to pads. So after this, we really felt like, okay, this is a need that is obviously unfilled in this area, and people are really excited about the pads. So we continued. It was a really great summer of building more relationships with schools and kind of figuring out if this was a way to be connected to the community. And this is my daughter, Madeline, who's here with me now. So she was, how old was she? 7 in this picture. We went to a school. We were with my mom was there. This is my mom on the left, and the other women are my aunts. And so at this school, I thought it was such a great experience with having my daughter and my mom and my aunts, and one of my sisters was there. And I was like, what a great experience for my daughter. This must be really empowering for her to see these women role models. So we're leaving, and I say, Maddie, did you think that was so cool that you got to see what I did and hear your aunts and your grandma talk about that? She said, no, I wish I never knew any of that. So it was now she laughs about that story. But so we kept building on this project. And while I was there that summer, I got an email from someone who said, I'd like to learn more about your pad project, and that she lived in Colorado. And we didn't have very much internet connection, nor really a good phone service, so I said, okay, I'll be home, I can talk to you in August. But she kept emailing me, was very persistent, so I finally arranged to call her, and it turned out that her name's Casey Anderson, and she's an evolutionary ecologist who lives in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is kind of by Summit County up in the mountains. And her best friend from college is a guy named Sadler Miller, who owns a cloth diaper company called Thirsties. And she was convinced, she's really passionate about education, and she was convinced that there was some way to have cloth diaper technology used for menstrual pads, and that we should start an organization together. So I was kind of thinking, well, I have 3 kids, I already have a full-time job, I'm not sure that I'm in for this, but she was one of the most persistent people I've ever met, and she kept going in. We ended up forming a nonprofit organization called For the Good Period. And we field tested pads. We did a bunch of fabric testing of all different kinds of absorbency, and we made prototypes and sent them to Kenya and had girls test them. And I learned a lot about the absorbency of fabrics, and even we had to research what the average amount of menstrual flow was and how we could absorb that. So we ended up making these pads as a final product. And they're made with fine layer of terry cloth, and then the outside is PUL, which is a waterproof fabric. And so we made these kits. In 1 year, we made 1,000 of them. And then they also added this year, or in this type, a wet bag. So I don't know if anyone has used cloth diapers recently, but they include a wet bag that has a zipper on the top that keeps them from leaking to the outside. And then it also decreases the odor if you have wet diapers, like in a diaper bag. And so that was one of the things that we found was really important, that girls had told us that they liked the pads, but that sometimes there was an odor to them if they were waiting to wash them when they kept them at school. So we made pads with this organization, and we were kind of like, well, I thought, well, let's see what happens next, because I have enough time in my day to keep going with students, but I don't know what's going to happen with this organization. And in the meantime, we had another Pints and Pads event that continued to get bigger. The brewery now gives us a profit of all the beer that they sell in the night, and it's really great. So this year, we established the For the Good Period. We had this big fundraising event. We had all these awesome pads, and we're ready to go back to Tharaka County and distribute them. But unfortunately, that year, if some of you ever heard of the attack at Garissa University in Kenya, there was a terrorist attack where there were many students that were killed at a university, and that happened about 20 days before we were supposed to go on our trip. So our university said, yeah, you can't take 19 students to Kenya right now. So within 6 days, we rescheduled our entire trip and went to Malawi instead, which was really an interesting experience because I didn't know if this pad issue was universal to many parts of Africa or if it was just Kenya. And what we found out is that there is the same issue in Malawi. We visited some schools, and when we were in Malawi, one of the schools that we went to, a nurse from the hospital came with us, and that was the first time that we really used someone outside of our own organization to go with us, and she was fantastic. She had the students singing songs about pads. She did a lot of sexual and reproductive health education, and it really gave us a desire to think, how can we do this, that this is not us coming to do something, but that we have a partnership with people who are here, and a good reminder that people here are also capable of being really good educators about issues that are important. So we went back and continued with our Pints and Pads event, and we were going to just focus on making the pads that we had through For the Good Period with the cloth diaper technology. But it turned out that even when we weren't asking people to make pads, people kept making them. So we, like, within the course of a year, I had over 1,000 more pad kits that people just kept making. So we decided that if we really wanted people to support the work we were doing, they needed to feel that they could do something. So we had them start making these cinch bags. So these are just cloth bags that are about this big, and then they have a drawstring at the top so that we could it's not the same as doing the wet bag for the good period pads, but it could still be something that they could carry pads in, and it could be something fun for them. So this is just the haul after one of our Pints and Pads events in my living room.
Molly, do you buy the fabric, or do they bring fabric?
People usually at a Pints and Pads event, they buy a little bit of fabric, but then people generally bring their own fabric, or we have some groups, like church groups, that make the strips, but then we need people to sew around them, or they'll half make the bags and then people finish them and put the thread in, things like that. So we went again in 2016 and we delivered 8,000 pads to people in Kenya, and it continued to go really well. We this year had a nurse who I had met 2 years before who went with us. His name was Pauline, and that was really cool. Then we went as an organization, as For the Good Period, in September of 2016 and delivered our 1,000 pad packs. We also really started trying to think more intentionally about the work we were doing during this time. So we worked closely with Millicent, the nurse that I first met when I was 19, as well as Pauline, the nurse who had done some of the distribution with us. And we also established a community board of directors. So it was important for us to figure out how we could fit in the community and partner with work that was already being done. So as I mentioned in my talk before, menstrual hygiene management is just one of many, many issues that affect the health and well-being of girls. So it's really easy to start saying, oh, we work on a project that helps empower girls. And people will say, oh, so do you work on female genital mutilation? Well, not really, but that sounds like that's important, we should do that. Oh, do you work on providing birth control? No, but we should. So we were like suddenly feeling we could just go in a million directions. And we really wanted to figure out what was going on in the communities themselves. So we formed this board of directors with people from different organizations. And we had a few community stakeholder meetings where we invited people who worked on things like female genital mutilation and who worked as teachers or focused on education for girls. And we had them all come together and talk about the work they did and tried to figure out how we could kind of work along with them instead of for them or against them. And it was really helpful because we learned a lot about just the basic need for community development and the involvement of parents and community members instead of just showing up and doing things. So this is one of the For the Good Period distributions. And we had girls from multiple schools that came this time. So we had a big planning meeting during this time, and I just was going to share, this is sort of what we came up with on how we would want to work with communities. So what was really important to us is that we think about it as trying to build partnerships with community members that involve capacity building and sustainability planning so that we could eventually start the project, stay in a community for 2 to 3 years, and then be done in a community so that we wouldn't just say, okay, we'll forever provide sanitary pads because they don't need that. There are many resources. Some of them are really different than what we think of as resources, but there are ways to address the problems. So our first phase, which is where we are in most of our communities, we have 13 communities right now where we're working, is really just trying to identify who are the community gatekeepers. So we try to figure out religious leaders. They have chiefs in each of the kind of tribal chiefs in each of the communities. So we work with the chiefs and try to find out who they are. And then there, so we do that at the community level, and then we do it at the school level. So within each school, there are teachers, there's a head teacher, a principal, there are parent boards, a PTA, and so we get those people and try to meet with them to talk about what they think are issues for girls and what they see as challenges around menstruation. We also do some community assessment and development planning, so trying to figure out where is the community in terms of development. If we're talking about issues of sanitation, do most people even have sanitation or toilets in their homes? Do they have toilets at school? What is the sanitation scene? Because that would matter in terms of how we're trying to advocate for menstrual hygiene management. And then we collect some community indicators about wealth and kind of income status. So we try to do all those things before really beginning in a community. And then the intervention planning and implementation is the 2 to 5 years. And what we're trying to do right now is really figure out how we can do more monitoring and evaluation, because there is a lot of work going into menstrual hygiene management, but we don't know for sure how effective it is. So it's important for us to collect some indicators so that we can see if what we're doing is actually making a difference. We also really decided that it would be important to do some more seminars and involve parents more. So over the course of time, we've done, I think, 3 now seminars where we've had girls and their parents come together, because one of the pieces of feedback we got from mothers when we did this initial community assessment part was, yeah, we'd really like you to come and talk to our daughters, but we want to know the information too, because no one ever told us. So that was part of kind of thinking, how do we change communities? And then training some community workers. So now we've, within each of the areas where we work, have a community person that's getting trained to do the work when we're not there, and thinking about how to create that sustainability. And then in the long term, or phase 3, our goal is really to figure out how we can source the pads locally. So we've tried twice now to train tailors and have them make pads in Kenya. The first time, our biggest challenge was trying to find the PUL, or the waterproof material, because that is what makes the pads really nice and user-friendly, is that they indeed don't leak. That was nearly impossible to get in Kenya. So we then, the second time, brought some PUL from the United States and sourced some of the other fabrics there. But it's been really difficult to keep a trained tailor. As it turns out, in rural areas, people who have employable skills generally don't want to stay in the rural communities because they can't make as much money. So every time we seem to get a tailor who's good at tailoring and is reliable, she leaves. So we're having a little bit of an issue of trying to keep people there, but we're still working on that and trying to figure out how to make that happen. And then we're trying to think about how we can get to really, really even more difficult to reach areas. So one of the things that I really like about working in Kenya is that people are really interested in helping each other. So even though you might be in a community where people have absolutely nothing, they will scrape together the fewest coins they can to help a family in need. So the idea that we could help people in hard to reach areas reach people in even harder to reach areas makes sense in that culture. And so then eventually, hopefully, we just exit from the communities and have tried to kind of add a catalyst to the already things that exist in ways that they know how to do their own work. And then along the bottom is just really our emphasis on trying to continue doing monitoring and evaluation. And I guess an update since this, we now have 2 employees who work for the Good Period and live in Kenya, so we now actually have been trying to do consistent enough fundraising to pay Millicent, who's the nurse, to be the director of programs in Kenya. So she now has a salary that we pay her, and we also just hired another young nurse who's going to help her do work in Kenya. So this is just an example of community development planning and how we kind of, what the steps that we look at of trying to work with the communities themselves. So again, it's trying to involve the community in the planning of anything that we do, as well as implementation of those things. And then I think what's important for us to remember, and not always easy, is the last part of delegation, referral to other, and referral to other organizations. Because as a community tells you their needs, it's easy for them to say, yeah, we have a need for our girls that they need pads, but we also really need a well, and we really need solar power, and you know, we can't do all of those things. So that's part of the importance of working in partnership with other organizations of saying, you're right, that is a really important need, but we can't do that. Here's who can. So these are just a couple highlights of in 2016, when we went for the Good Period, we were going to some of the communities where we had already given pads to talk to girls that had received them to ask how they were working and if they liked them and just get some general feedback. So this girl in the middle showed up to meet with us because we asked the area manager who was working with us if he could find some girls that already had gotten the pads. And she came and he asked her, do you remember when you got these pads? And she said, yes, I remember that was Molly's program. I tell everyone that Molly's program is very good because she told us important things. And I was like, what? That was 3 years ago. And she remembered all of those. She could recite things that I had told her from our experience. And she still used the pads that she had, though the flannel liners were getting kind of worn out because they wash them by hand and hang them to dry, and so they get a little brittle. But it was shocking to me because I kept thinking, you know, you never know when you do work like this. It feels good as a person doing it, but you're not ever sure if it actually makes an impact. So that was really a cool thing that happened. So this was our Pints and Pads event this year, and we just went again this last spring. And this year there were 20 students that went, including 6 male students, which was really cool because one of the things that we had been thinking about is that we were doing this emphasis of working on girls, but you can imagine in a patriarchal country where girls have long been oppressed, men get a little itchy when people are saying, like, let's raise up the girls a little bit, and keep saying, well, what about the boys? What about the boys? And I mean, I had a lot of opinions about what about the boys, like, okay, this is called us, like, equalization. We're not raising anyone above. We're just bringing them up to the boys, but I didn't feel it was my place to say that. So I kept asking, well, what do you think the boys need to know? What can we do for them? They don't need pads. And they said, well, you can bring them a soccer ball. I said, okay, well, that's not the same because we're giving education and pads. So if we can do education with the boys, then we'll bring them a soccer ball. So this year it was really fun. We went to 3 different schools, and each time I took 2 of the boys. And so this is the collection of boys. And what we did is the same talk that we do with the girls, which included puberty, talking about sexual and reproductive health, talking about consent, talking about empowerment of girls, and did it with the boys, which was really interesting for me. They, again, were like most boys. When I mentioned things like erections and ejaculation, they were like they did not expect you to say those things. And then they started laughing, but then they asked a bazillion questions. And then we talked about if you thought it was okay to beat your wife. And they all said, yeah, yeah. And so then I asked my students who were there, do you beat your girlfriends? And they were like, no. And so we had a conversation about why you would beat someone or why you wouldn't beat someone. And it was really interesting and fun and kind of a first attempt at trying to bring boys into the conversation about the status of women and girls, because I think that's a really important part of creating a new context for empowering girls. This is just one of the girls who was part of our programs, and this is a fuzzy cell phone picture, but during this time we went back to CARE, the very first school that I mentioned where we did the first research and one of the first distributions. And this girl came back to the school, and she was now going to university and still using the pads from the very first year that we gave them to her. So there were 2 recent times that we got some really good feedback that this was important. So moving forward, as we continue to think about what we're doing and why we're doing it and how we partner and what partnerships look like, it's sometimes very exhausting because the problems are really complex and there's never an end to the work that you do. Because every time you start to think about how do you, you've created one solution, you've almost always created another problem. So, for example, at the schools, we've asked girls, okay, you can use these menstrual pads at school, but now they don't have a place to wash them at school. So then they were washing them and there was contaminated water getting out in the school or whatever. So we were like, okay, so now the problem is that they don't have the right kind of latrine to use at school. So it's been interesting to think about that. So we've been thinking about this idea of trying to make girl-friendly latrines. So how can we help them have a latrine that would allow them to wash the pad at school, not contaminate the water or the health of other people, but be a friendly place for them to change their pads. So I am now a part of a project that's called the Latrine Digester Project, which is a whole nother partnership that I had no idea about, but I knew this woman, Maureen Jokey Kanua. She's on the faculty at UC Davis. She went to school in Fargo for her undergraduate degree, and I met her then. And so she's from Kenya, but not from this area. And she has a PhD in environmental engineering. And we were randomly talking about this issue, and she was like, oh, I know what you should do. You should make the latrine digester, because then you can improve sanitation, but we can digest all of the waste from the toilet, and they can use it for cooking gas, the methane for cooking gas, so they can use the composted waste for fertilizer. And she was like, and then they can wash their pads because the menstrual blood is really high in nutrients, and after it's been through the latrine digester, it can also be used for nutrients in crops. And I was like, okay, this seems really overwhelming, but now that's what we're working on, is trying to, these are some of the early sketches of what this can look like. We had some meetings last fall where we went and met with the members of this one pilot school from the community of trying to figure out if this would actually work, which were also really fun conversations of not just talking in a circle of mostly male leaders of the community about menstruation and how you have to wash a pad, but also talking about that these toilets require a separation of solid and liquid waste in order for it to work properly. So trying to ask questions about, do you think you can do this if you're squatting? Can you separate these things, and are you willing to do that? And that they have to actually interact with waste, because that's not usually something they do either. If you just go to the bathroom in a bowl, you never see the waste even. You just go to the bathroom and leave. So this is a whole new process, but basically what it is that instead of in the community where we are piloting this, it's going to be really beneficial to them because they have a really high level of bedrock. So for them to dig latrines is really difficult, and they have to build them so deep, and then they fill up and they have to rebuild them. But these are actually built above ground, and then the waste goes into these big collection pipes and drains down to a anaerobic digester where the methane is taken out, and then it is the pathogens are somehow dealt with in some magical way that I don't fully understand, and then they can actually remove all of that composted waste and use it. So as I said, one thing leads to another, and they seem to get more and more complex, but it's kind of exciting to think about that this really does place the idea of menstrual hygiene in both within a system of this is a part of a bigger health issue, but also part of us, like it can be part of the solution too. So I think that's kind of cool. So that's a quick overview of how we've worked in partnership and the work that we've been doing in rural Kenya. That's my last slide to say thank you. And I'd love to answer questions. And
the toilet system, is it crazy expensive?
It is pretty expensive, and you know what was really interesting is, it's again, the part process of working in a country that's really corrupt like Kenya, and people are, even though Jokey is from Kenya, she's lived in the United States a long time, so she's really not, but these are really simple drawings, like she just wanted even metal-sided things. The person who gave us the bid sent back a drawing, and they were porcelain sinks, everything was tiled on the inside, and so we got the bid back, and we're like, oh my gosh, that is, each latrine was gonna cost somewhere around I think it was $18,000. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking it would be like $3,000 per latrine. So it could be really expensive. I think the digester process and all of that is a little bit more expensive, but yeah, it will be interesting to see there. You know, there are so many issues involved in even this. It's a day school, so they have a lot of kids, but one of the issues is most of them are malnourished. So I don't even know if they can produce enough solid waste to make enough to get the digester to the level it needs to be. So we even had conversations about, can you collect waste from your livestock and bring it here? Can you bring food scraps from home to put in? Like, it's really a whole composting system that will be interesting to see how well it works. So, but they're excited about it because they don't have, they still use fire for cooking, mm-hmm. which is so bad for the environment in terms of deforestation, but also so bad for the health of women. There are studies showing that for women who cook over open fires, it's the equivalent to smoking 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day. So you walk into their kitchens at the school and they're just filled with smoke. So it would be a great way to try to help them.
Yeah. So do they have this system any place?
There are other systems sort of like this, but not in any of the Rockanithi County areas. And this is the... What Jokey engineered, which I guess is somehow different than other systems. Yeah, my role in this project is going to talk to people to ask them about like what they do when they're cooking, how much they fetch water, where they go to the bathroom, things like that.
Molly, you mentioned involving the leaders of the community. You mm-hmm. said the chief. I'm assuming it's a man.
Yeah, but most of the chiefs are, but there are often assistant chiefs, who some of them have been women.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, with a lot of the male hierarchy, and you want to bring up empowering women, you were talking about the boys and that, how are you able to get their buy-in? Mm-hmm.
You know, that's actually something that is, it's always hard for me because people want, well, in Kenya, I think that a lot of times people are not always sincere about their buy-in. They have a high dependency on outside organizations and aid, and they're used to people coming and giving them things. So oftentimes, especially if they see an organization that involves white people, like that you'll show up and say, we're interested in doing this. Would you be willing to have us come and do this education and bring pads to your girls? They'll say yes just because they get something. And it's not an authentic, like, we also think this issue is important. So it's a fine line for me to try to figure out, is someone agreeing to work with us or be a part of our project because they truly believe they want to do it? Or is it because they're getting something? Or, like, we were there and had some meetings with people and it was really close to an election. And every single person was like, yes, I'm going to do that. And come with me. I'd like you to go and meet all of these people. And I could tell, I was like, oh, you're just like parading us around because this is part of your campaigning. And so it's been a fine line. And we've identified the area manager that works in Karde. He is fantastic. He is so passionate about this project. He loves empowering girls. And he's been a very, very big asset because there's no question if he's authentic and wants to be a part of this. And he'll do lots of things, and he'll gather people. He's really good at going out and finding the important people that we need to talk to and getting people to get together. So there are cases where it's clear, but there are others that I think it's difficult. And really, I think the best approach that I usually use is saying, so trying to link, like, if you can educate girls, then they can earn more money. And when they earn more money, that helps your family, that helps your community. When you have an educated mother, you have more educated children, you have healthier children, and trying to talk about the benefit of girls, how they can help families and communities, because those are really important values in the Kenyan culture. Which feels also a little bit not like so in line with like, you should just value them because they're women and they deserve to be valued. But that's kind of the roundabout way that we sometimes talk about it.
So did the when you had said you did the community clinic and you had ladies in their 80s, did they not understand that they no longer needed them? Or was it just because they could finally have something that was theirs?
I think they just wanted something. I don't even think that some of them knew exactly what they were. Okay. And truth be told, as many as there are great examples of people saying these are awesome, we'd like to use them. There was one distribution that we did that we gave the For the Good Period pad packs to, which are really nice, and they have the nice wet bag with the zipper, and the squares for the liners were about this big and bright green. And so we did the distribution, and afterward we went to the market, and it was just this huge outdoor market, and we saw one of the girls walking along carrying the wet bag as her purse and the green liner as her handkerchief. And I was like, okay, this is a good reminder of the fact, like, you can give people gifts, but you can't tell them what to do with them. So it has a use. It might not have the use that we wanted it to, but I think there are probably cases where it doesn't get used exactly how you expect it to, but I think as in that aspect, you don't really get to decide that. And so one time some girls told us that other girls at their school were just throwing them in the latrine after they used them once. So, I think there is some misuse, but for the most part, so other girls have told us they use them and share them with their mothers. So I think you have to find a balance somewhere between that. So the Pints and Pads is a fundraising event for us. And then For the Good Period has some other fundraising events. So mostly just donations. We're trying to find a way to get some grants or bigger funding, but a lot of that requires, you know, several years of experience and some demonstrated outcomes, so we're trying to collect some more of that before we can find more support.
So what can we do to help you?
Well, if you're going to be here tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the pads, and if you sew, you can make pads. We always love donations. I have actually some pamphlets I can give you so you can look at the website and see more information. Those are probably our biggest needs, are the drawstring bags and pads or monetary donations. Yeah. So I'll put these up here. I want to take one of these, if you can.
Oops. Every time there's a local brewery, though.
I know. This year we had a Pints and Pads event, one in Fargo, one in Breckenridge, Colorado, and one in Denver, Colorado. Yeah, so it's been kind of fun. And there's also like Pinot and Pads events where people have had wine and pad events. We've had, there was a girl in Colorado who did an event where she called it Pennies for Pads. And she had other middle students in her middle school and had other students all bring pennies and they bought panties and then donated money to the organization. So that was fun. We've had some yoga events where people have come to like a short presentation about the organization and then done yoga and made a contribution. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a whole other big business and part of marketing and fundraising and development. That
in your spare time.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about that.
Like, I don't know. What was the type of fabric you said? P-L?
P-U-L.
I don't know. What does that stand for?
I don't know.
Okay.
So is that the same, like if Joanne's has a little section?
And tomorrow I have samples of all the pads.
Great.
So I'll bring all of that tomorrow. And wonderful. Or if you're not going to be here, I can show it to you otherwise. But yeah, and it's kind of like, I don't know, it doesn't really feel crunchy like you would expect a waterproof fabric to feel. It's like flexible and kind of,
it's soft.
Yes.
As a chemist, I think that PU is probably polyurethane. I don't know what the L would be.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. Yeah, it feels like it had polyurethane.
Any other questions for Molly? Come back tomorrow. We'll have the patterns, and then Molly's going to send me the electronic, the PDF of the handouts we'll have tomorrow, and then we'll post it on the website. So, okay.
And I have some cards. I'll put these out in case you're not going to be here tomorrow. You can email me.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pretty overwhelming.
No, it's okay. I always sometimes feels like just a big mess.
So, how did you said when you were 19, like she inspired you. And so, like, how did you start? I guess maybe I missed that class yesterday. Coming, like, knowing that this was a concern, like, was it your, when you were 19, did Melissa say that this is an issue, or?
It was when I went back to do the research and the, and was just asking about barriers and facilitators of health, and then the girls started telling me about not being able to go to school when they had their period.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then that's a, has to be a similar issue, just like we said, in a lot of other developing countries.
Yeah.
It's got to be.
I think it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And in parts of the United States,
yeah,
even like American Indian reservations, I know it's a really big issue.
Yeah.
Homeless shelters.
Oh, I think it's the 14th.
Okay. It is.
Yeah.
Right. I had to come back on Saturday.
Keep it in my pocket.
Well, and we were, after your session Monday, was walking with my friends, and they were like, yeah, well, that would have been our mothers. I mean, it's not that long ago here either. And granted, it still happens, so I get that, but it's like even for...
There was a lady once who sent me a box of pads, and I don't know how old she was, but she had the pads all so neatly packaged. They were each tied with a like little silk ribbon, and she said, I wrote a note, something about, I can remember when I was young and didn't have pads before pads were available like they are today, and this issue really spoke to me, and there's a bunch of pads. So,
any idea what they're doing in those massive refugee camps?
Yeah, that's another area that I think...
I can't imagine.
Yeah, that's a huge, high-need area that, again, like, that's where I was like, okay, now we have pads, we have extra ones here we're not using right now, let's go to, like, refugee camps and
right.
We just go... But there are, and there are other organizations that do focus on pad distribution in refugee camps. But I still think it's a high need, especially the education that goes around the pad distribution.
So when you fly with all the tubs,
mm-hmm.
do the airlines charge you for that extra baggage?
Well, so that's, we usually take them when we take students.
Okay.
So each of us get two bags, and each student can bring
okay.
one, and then we have like 23 more bags that we can check.
Okay.
Otherwise, usually if we get to the airport and we have extra bags, I just say, oh, these are panties and sanitary pads for girls in Kenya, and then like, would you be willing to check them for free? They usually are like, okay, don't talk about that anymore.
Oh, good for them. I mean, at least they just, yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And are all your students nursing students
mm-hmm.
that go? Okay,
yeah.
I thought so. But
yeah.
Some
well, the summer that I stayed there over the summer, I had a graduate student who is a master's of public health student.
Oh, okay.
A student
yeah.
or field experience. But.
Yeah. Okay. So tomorrow at 2:45, right? Do I have a break?
Yep. Oh.